Raising decent, secure, and happy kids, the simple way.
Those forces coming into our family from marketing, from media, from ubiquitous stress, from everywhere we look, there's almost like there's an undeclared war on childhood.
That's Kim John Payne. We'll be talking with him later in the show about his book, Simplicity Parenting. But first, we talk with celebrated elementary school teacher Rafe Esquith about his book, Lighting Their Fires. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. At a time when charter schools are taking over public schools, and public schools in poor communities sink ever deeper into crisis, there's at least one classroom in one school in central Los Angeles that's bucking the trend. The school is Hobart Elementary, and the classroom belongs to teacher Rafe Esquith. The kids come from homes where English is not the native language, where parents struggle to put food on the table and pay the rent. But Rafe Esquith students excel against the odds, not only on standardized tests, but also in their dedication to hard work and learning. And to some great literature, too. Some of you may have seen the PBS documentary about Esquith and his school project, The Hobart Shakespeareans. But his work with kids goes far beyond putting on great plays. He uses music, literature, and sports to teach his kids the basics. Not just reading and math, but character and decency. Author of several books, including a bestseller written for teachers, Rafe Esquith is now out with a book just for parents. It's called Lighting Their Fires. I spoke with Rafe Esquith in December. You teach at Hobart Elementary School in L.A.
I do.
And tell us a little bit about the school. Are these really extraordinary kids, or are they kind of ordinary kids?
They're just like everybody else, and so is their teacher, by the way. Hobart Elementary School is a classic public school in central Los Angeles with far too many children. 92% of the kids are below the poverty level, and none of them speak English as a first language. They are neighborhood kids. They are not bussed in for some magical program. But because I've stayed put for a long time, I've learned a few things about teaching and tried to learn from my mistakes. And we've created a pretty special classroom there, and I'm a very lucky teacher.
You know, I want to ask you just the one question I didn't feel got answered by your book, and that is, in this time of teaching to the test, in this time of NCLB, how are you able to create such a phenomenal and really unusual program?
Well, actually, it's interesting you say that. I think in a subtle way, I did answer it in the book, and I'll tell you how. The book, Lighting Their Fires, takes place in only one night. And nothing magical happens that night. The kids and I go to a baseball game. We are surrounded by some pretty drunken and boorish fans, which is, you know, part of the world they're growing up in. And what I hope the reader sees is that every day matters. Every day I try to set an example that might be different than the world in which the children are growing up. In this world of teaching for the test and everything, you know, all teachers following a script, I don't do that. I basically have said, I'm going to do things differently. And yes, in my early years, I took a lot of flack for that. The first book I ever wrote, There Are No Shortcuts, chronicles, you know, what good teachers go through. The joke I always tell people is that Socrates was the best teacher who ever lived, and they killed him. So, of course I took a lot of flack, but the reason I was able to win was that my students started outperforming everybody in the school following those scripts because of the qualities that I'm working on in Lighting Their Fires. So I hope the answer to your question is that there's not a magical moment. It's every day. Parents have to work with their kids every day. They want to have dinner with their kids every night with the television off, talking about the issues that are in the newest book.
So what you're really saying, you know, with all this emphasis on, you know, the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, kind of teaching the basics, as people call them, you really locate the basics in character.
Of course. I mean, in other words, one of the points I make in the book is, and by the way, let's make this clear, I have no problem with testing. I want to see how the kids are doing. I just don't think it's a complete picture of a child. Tests don't measure their abilities to make decisions, their abilities to be decent, and their abilities to understand their use of time. So, for example, one of the points I make in the book is more than half of the children today who make it to college don't finish.
Wow.
And obviously, these are bright people. I mean, they made it to college. They know how to write papers and pass exams. And I would suggest that the reason they're not finishing college is because they're not real good at life. And everybody who's been to college knows the hardest part of college isn't the classes. It's, you know, what do you do if you're having problems with your girlfriend or boyfriend? Or what do you do when you have money problems? What do you do when you're sick and your mom isn't there with Tylenol? How do you handle these things? And this is the kind of thing we spend time in my class doing to supplement the three R's. I think the three R's are a beginning. They're certainly not the end, but they become the end in many schools. And I think in Running, Lighting Their Fires, I'm trying to get our country to refocus on things that really matter.
You talk about a backpack that parents can give to kids, metaphorically speaking.
Right.
What are some of these qualities, some of these tools that parents should put into the backpack?
Well, one of the things is that our children right now have no concept of time. They spend their time very poorly. They're usually in front of a television set or in front of a computer screen, and there are better ways for them to spend time. The sad part is that what a lot of teachers and parents are doing these days is when they realize the kid is spending their time poorly, they bully the child into forcing them to spend their time, whether they take a TV away or take a video game away. My philosophy is to show the child that there are better ways to spend time, but let the child make that decision.
How would they do that?
Well, you do it by showing them the relevance of their decision. In other words, in my classroom, if you were talking about the test before, if you ask most children, why are we doing something? Why are you learning division? The kids will say to you, well, because it's on the test, or we have to. In my class, my 10-year-olds will say, I'm learning this because if I know this skill, my life just got better.
Give us an example. Why would their life be better if they were actually reading and not watching TV?
Here's how we do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you watch a cooking channel and they're making chicken, and they say, we're making chicken, and they show you a wonderful chicken, and it looks really good, and then they show you how to make it, but they show you the finished product. Our children today do not have a vision of the finished product. They only know about now, right now. I want to play this game. I want to do this activity. I don't want to think a year from now or 5 years from now. I don't care about what's going on 5 years from now. What I do is I constantly bring into my room former students. I introduce 10-year-olds to people who are 14 years old, 15 years old, 18 years old, returning from high school, returning from college, who are very successful, pursuing things that they are passionately in love with and having a great time doing it, so that my students start to see a longer picture. In the book, I talk about the great Stanford study about two marshmallows.
I'm right. Tell us that one.
Where, you know, it's an amazing thing where in 1970, a professor at Stanford took a group of four-year-old children one by one into a room and gave them each a marshmallow and told the child, you can eat it. And then the guy said, oh, hang on a minute. I forgot. I left something outside the office. Here's what we're going to do. I've got to leave you for a minute, buddy. And you can eat the marshmallow, but if you wait till I come back, you can have two marshmallows. And then they watched the children through a window. And, of course, some of the four-year-olds just gobbled up the marshmallow. But other kids waited up to 20 minutes for the guy to return. And then they tracked those children for 18 years. And all of the children who waited for the second marshmallow did better in school, had longer-lasting marriages, did better in everything. Because even at the age of four, they had understood the concept of delayed gratification.
And
we have a fast-food society. We want it now. And I'm showing children that really, rather than thinking of just the end result, let's work on the process of getting to the end. And by working on process rather than just the end results, that's why my students are very patient. And here we are at a school where only 32% of the kids even finish high school. And my students all finish college because of what they learn in the fifth grade.
That is the oldest grade, isn't that, at your school?
Yes, it used to be sixth grade, and then the school was so crowded they dropped it.
And you're only one of several fifth-grade teachers?
Oh, yes, that's right.
So tell us, how do you teach this, you know, with the two marshmallows idea?
Well, of course, the first rule of parenting, the first rule, is we have to be the people we want our children to be. For example, I want my children to become readers, and we read only literature in my classroom, and I have four children of my own. Every night, I read. That's what my children saw. I read all day, even when my students come into my classroom at 6:30 in the morning, because they volunteer to come in early, I'm sitting there reading. when we're on the road, I read all the time. When we're on airplanes, airports, and so do my students. They don't play with games. And it's not that they're not allowed to. They're around somebody who they trust and look up to who reads all the time. I want my students to be nice. And you can't scream at children to be nice. That's a mixed message. So the first rule of parenting, if we want our children to do these things and perhaps not buy into the culture, then we have to have parents who don't buy into the culture. Just because all children, you know, think, well, we have to have a video game system in the house. Actually, you don't. You can raise children to say, well, in our house we do things differently. We spend our time a little differently. And then set the example.
We're speaking with teacher Rafe Esquith about his latest book, Lighting Their Fires. He's also the author of There Are No Shortcuts and the best-selling book for teachers, Teach As If Your Hair's on Fire. A PBS movie was made about his innovative teaching, The Hobart Shakespeareans. You have actually a wonderful example in the book of this, of kind of this culture clash, actually. And that is when your students and you were going on a plane to Washington, D.C. tell us what happened got to the checkout line.
Everybody buys into this where when we're going on, and this happens a lot, that was just one example, but if we're waiting in line at the security lines, the TSA people who work very hard, the TSA people are saying, okay, kids, you have to take all your, Game Boys out of your backpacks. And the kids say, well, we don't have them. And the TSA people go, kids, it's a machine, we're going to find them. And the kids say, we really don't have them. And then when they get to the airplane and they're on the jet bridge, the stewardess will panic and say, oh, well, look at all these kids. We'll get you all DVD players. And we'll say, well, why are you doing that? Well, because it's a five-hour flight. You've got to be entertained. And the kids say, well, we're going to read. That's what we do. So even adults are pressuring them to buy into things which really are hurting them. I mean, certainly now that we know that the average American child is in front of a screen 7 hours a day, well, I don't think any clear-thinking parent thinks this is a good thing. We have to set the example to show them there are alternate ways of spending a life.
Yeah, in fact, your flight attendant said, you said to the flight attendant, they have books they're going to read, and the flight attendant said, you can do that?
You can do that? I mean, she was truly, and because you have to understand, and this was a nice lady, but she had seen so many school groups who run around airplanes, who misbehave, who kick the seats in front of them. It's perfectly understandable for her to feel that way, given her experiences. But the fact that it's so unusual, and it shouldn't be, is really a very sad comment on our society. I don't know if you're familiar with the great British actor Ian McKellen.
Oh, yeah.
He's a huge patron of ours. He's my biggest supporter. And I think he has the best line ever about my class. He says he always cries when he comes there. It's tears of happiness, but it's also regret that not all children are receiving this education.
Now, he's, of course, a great Shakespearean actor. You have used Shakespeare. You started working with kids. Were they fifth graders and fourth graders with Shakespeare?
Yeah, actually, even fourth graders in our school joined me for Shakespeare.
So that's pretty phenomenal. I mean, I remember, I think I was 11 when I discovered Shakespeare.
Right.
Actually, my father was annoyed because I wasn't getting very good grades in school because I was reading all the time. And he took away my library card, so I was forced to read adult books that were
right
in the house, and I discovered Shakespeare, and you know, kind of nothing was ever the same again. It just opened up a whole new dimension of language to me. But, you know, most kids, if they read Shakespeare, don't start until high school.
Right.
So tell us, how do you get the kids to understand Shakespeare?
Okay, well, let's talk about two things. First of all, I'd be happy to talk about that. I happen to really like Shakespeare. I always have. He was my bedtime story for my father. It was early at the age of 3. So I really like him. And one of the things I really encourage parents and teachers to do is to share your passions with your children. It doesn't mean everybody has to go out there and do Shakespeare. You can do the same thing with a gardening club. But I happen to like Shakespeare. What we do in our classroom is Shakespeare was never meant to be read. He was meant to be heard. I mean, that's what he was thinking about when he wrote those plays. So what we do is and since my students don't speak English as their first language, when they have the text in front of them, we listen to Shakespeare because all of it's recorded. You can download it on any iPod. And one of the funny things that happens in my classroom is that the kids start memorizing Shakespeare because they can learn Shakespeare as easily as they learn, you know, rock and rap songs.
The funny thing is some of them start developing British accents. And I have to tell the children it's really okay to speak with a Spanish accent or a Vietnamese or a Korean accent. And I have to actually teach them to use their own voices. But what happens is I take the time to go through it with them. We understand every word of what we're saying because good parents, and that's what teaching really is, it is like being a parent, good parents spend a lot of time with their children and not in front of a TV set. We talk about literature. We talk about the meaning so that when my 10-year-olds do an unabridged production of Shakespeare at the end of the year, we don't cut it. It's unabridged. And they understand every line. And it's not one superstar kid knowing his part. Everybody knows everybody's parts. It's amazing what kids can accomplish when they spend their time doing kind of different things than most kids do. It's amazing to the world, but it's not amazing to us. But the bigger picture I want you to understand is what they're really learning. Because if you ask my children, what are you learning by doing a Shakespeare play? They will tell you they're learning about teamwork, and they're learning about trying new things and taking chances. They learn about the arts. And they learn about delayed gratification, that this takes a long, long time, that for the first month or two of doing Shakespeare, they have very little understanding of what they're doing. But in that third or fourth month, it starts to make sense. And by the seventh month, they speak it the way you would speak Dr. Seuss. So what they're learning is in the rest of their lives, when they have challenging projects, the understanding that it takes a long time to get good at anything, be it a baseball player or a geographer, those are skills they carry with them for the rest of their lives. And that's why we do Shakespeare.
One operative word that you said there that I thought was very important was passion.
Mm-hmm.
These seem to be extraordinarily passionate children. You've communicated your passion to them. Are you really saying that we need to awaken the passion that is in every child?
I think we do. And what's happening in schools, and that's why I wrote this book for parents, the schools now are telling teachers, all of you will be exactly the same, and all of you will read the same book. And they give teachers a script to follow. And the minute you're following somebody else's script, you stop being you. And that's when the passion dies out. You know, the show that you do, it's your show. You come up with the questions. You pursue things that interest you. You're not following someone's script. That's why it's good. It's funny. It's ironic that we're supposed to be celebrating diversity, and yet because of No Child Left Behind, we're making all classrooms look exactly the same. And I think that's a very sad thing.
And if you kill the passion for teaching, you're going to kill the passion for learning.
Well, the saddest part of all is I meet so many great young teachers, because I speak all over the country, great young teachers. And they are discouraged because they come up with ideas, and they're good ideas, and people are saying, you can't do that. So one of my missions right now is to tell them, look, here I am a very ordinary guy, but I've stuck with it. You know, I've failed often. But I've stuck with it, and because of that, I've created a successful classroom, and you can too.
We're talking with Rafe Esquith, a master teacher, about his newest book, Lighting Their Fires, Raising Extraordinary Children in a Mixed Up, Muddled Up, Shook Up World. Now, in this book, you structure the book around this baseball game that you go to this one evening. Each chapter is a different inning.
Right.
In talking about time management, give us the example from the book that you use with this baseball game as being a lesson in time management for the kids.
Well, absolutely. I mean, everything is about time. And the kids notice, for example, we're in Los Angeles, and Dodger fans are notorious for showing up late to baseball games, where they come in like the third or fourth inning, and then they leave in like the seventh inning. I want the kids to see that because I want the kids to understand that when people aren't aware of time, they miss a lot. Again, this is that mentality where people will say, as long as I know what the final score was, I didn't miss anything. But because my kids have a real understanding of baseball and the nuances of the game, and I teach them how to score the game and the strategy behind the game, they realize that if you don't pay close attention and spend your time wisely, you miss a lot. And I want them to see the whole picture. If you go to a museum, you don't look at part of a Monet painting, you see the whole painting. And I feel the same way about every activity they do, to really take it in completely to the best of your ability, and that being on time means you have a better understanding of the world around you, and that being on time and appreciating your time gives you the sense that you have a control over your own destiny. There's a wonderful thing we do in my classroom every Friday where the kids look at their weekend and they look at the 60 hours or so in front of them before they're going to come back to school. And they realize that even after they take away their sleeping hours, even after they take away the hours they're eating and perhaps spending time with their families or going to church or cleaning their house or they're visiting their aunt, even if they were to spend maybe 10 or 12 hours just playing around, and there's nothing wrong with that because you're a kid, they still have 4 or 5 hours left to do some extra studying or reading if they manage their time well. And I'm not, you know, suggesting that, as sadly some schools are doing, where we want to turn our children into miniature adults, where they're studying 24 hours a day and only thinking about school. That's absurd. I want my students to roll in the mud and have water balloon fights and be silly.
And we'll gather.
You know, and that's absolutely right. It's great. But even that can be done, and at the same time, read a good book over the weekend or practice your musical instrument. Not because you have to, but because it's something you've chosen to do, that you enjoy doing. It's something you enjoy spending your time doing. And we do spend a lot about time talking about time in my classroom.
Well, it seems you're also really talking about choices.
Yeah.
And decision-making, because, I mean, I could imagine, I mean, children having to schedule their time down to the hour or even to the minute may not be the most comfortable thing or the kind of thing that we'd want to impose on children.
I agree.
But what you're really talking about here is making choices about how one spends one's life.
That's right. If I can give you an example, just yesterday, because we're actually 2 days ago, was the end of the week in school, and we have a band in my class, and the plays along with the Shakespeare play, and we are working on some very difficult keyboard arrangements for a Pink Floyd song we're doing. And it's tough stuff. This is tough work. And I have 4 kids that want to play keyboard on the song. And we talked about that. Well, okay, this is what you want to do. You've told me you really want to play keyboard. You want to be able to sound like the CD. How are we going to get there? And for the kids to say, well, to get there, because this is something I want to do, I'm going to have to set aside an hour of my weekend to do some practice. I don't have to set aside my whole weekend, and I don't have to decide that it's going to happen between 11:15 and 12:15 on Saturday morning. But for them to start thinking, like you said, about the decision, that if I make that decision, then come Monday when we rehearse, I'm going to feel really good about the fact that I've grown as a musician and that I'm ready to participate in this band. That's the kind of decision-making I want children to do, to understand why they're making the decision and what they get out of making a decision that benefits them.
Talk about rewards. You have a code of conduct. I mean, really, this is a lot about behavior, about values, about character. You talk about a code of conduct and developing that with kids, and you have a reward hierarchy, because it seems that in some way you're teaching kids how to have rewards that are higher on that hierarchy. Tell us what that is, that hierarchy.
Well, basically, when I was struggling as a young teacher, I came across the great social scientist Lawrence Kohlberg's Levels of Moral Development, and I simplified it for my students, and Kohlberg identified 6 levels of behavior, of why we do what we do. And my students absolutely love doing this because it really helps them understand other behavior and their own behavior. Level 1 thinking, most kids in school do things because they're afraid that if they don't, they're going to get in trouble. But I laugh with the kids and say, is that why you're doing math, to avoid trouble? Is that why we're working on an essay? That shouldn't be. And the 2nd level is when you do things for, you know, a reward, like an A or a gold star. But again, that really shouldn't be the reason you're working on a musical instrument. Level 3 is when we do things to please others. Level 4 is when we do things simply because it's a rule. But when you get into the higher levels, like level 5, where we do things because we're considerate of other people, I can take 60 of my students, and often do on the road, to a place like D.C. or the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, with only my wife and myself as chaperones. And my students don't ever make noise in a hotel room. But it's not because of a rule or they're going to get in trouble. They really are considerate of others. They're aware that there are people in the next room who might be trying to sleep. And it's not that my kids don't want to make noise. We make noise all the time. But they know that that's what a park is for. That's what the beach is for. No one asks them to hush down at a baseball game. But they should be able to tell themselves, you know, I'm already 10 years old, and I understand what a hotel is, and I'm not going to make noise here. And the highest level of thinking, level 6, is when the kids have a personal code of behavior that they've internalized. What you see a lot of children doing today is looking to their parent or looking to their teacher. Did I do this right? But eventually, the goal really should be that when we're not around, our kids are the kind of people we're trying to raise because they really internalize those values. We've certainly all seen the scene when adults are not around and kids misbehave until the adults come back. And if that were to ever happen in my classroom, I'd start laughing at it and say, guys, what are you behaving for me? What a strange way to live a life.
Right.
And because of that, and my students really like these conversations, people, you haven't been there. They're astonished that if I leave the room because a teacher needs my help or I have to use the restroom, my class keeps working. I trust them. Mm-hmm. And they trust me. They understand that the reason they're working is that it's going to help them with their lives, and that's why they keep working. And those six levels really help them build those values. Now, the funny thing is that I've had parents and teachers say, Rafe, I love the six levels, but I've done it for a week and my kids haven't reached level six yet. And I say, well, of course not. This is a long journey. There's that fast food creeping in again.
Well, that's actually...
You know, they're just a bunch of little kids. It takes them a long time to learn things, and I'm not in any hurry.
Well, that was one of my questions. I mean, undoubtedly, some of these kids, if not many of them, are coming from homes where these ideas are pretty foreign.
Oh, yeah.
How do you entice them into this?
Well, here's the deal. And by the way, let's make this clear. I fail all the time. Not every kid buys what I'm selling. And I really appreciate this question because I'm a little tired of parenting and teacher books where people say they save everybody and everybody, you know, it's not true. And they make those Hollywood movies where the teacher, you know, everybody passes the test. That doesn't happen. But I do entice them by this. Number one, it's a soft sell. In my, you used a great word, in my immature days as a teacher, you know, quarter of a century ago, if I had a kid who didn't want to stay after school to learn Shakespeare, I would say, you know, you're making a big mistake. This is important, and you should stay. It wasn't that I was ill-intentioned, but I really, you know, wanted to get the kids to stay. Now, at the beginning of the year, if a kid says, no, I don't want to stay, I want to go home, I say, okay. But what happens is, as time goes on through the year, he sees all these kids staying, and he sees them learning music, and they're all having a lot of fun. And slowly, the child comes to me and says, Rafe, is it okay if I, can I still join? And I say, of course you can. So my enticement is a soft sell where I simply keep setting the table with good food. And hopefully, after a while, I have a lot of faith that kids, when they see enough good food, many of them are going to start picking good things to eat. But it's very patient. I'm a very patient teacher.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking, well, you can use the example of other kids. You can use that, you know, basically the social, certainly not coercion, but the social enticement. Whereas a parent may not have that available. What are some ways in which parents can use some of that soft sell and build that into their very busy lives?
I think the most important thing that a parent can do that has unfortunately stopped happening in a lot of the families you're talking about is dinner. Dinner time certainly should be a time when the television is off. And right now, as I did my research, I've learned that in over 50% of American homes, a television is on 24 hours a day, even when someone's not watching it, which frightens me. A dinner conversation with your children. How was your day? How are things going? You're having a problem? How can I help you? Where you start explaining to them what's expected to be a member of our family. And by the way, most experts would tell you that children should be involved in the preparation of dinner, whether it's setting the table or cleaning the table or helping with the food, rather than just calling, Johnny, come on, dinner's ready. That 45 minutes to an hour a night can mean all the difference between having a successful child. If I could tell parents, you know, one or two things, dinner at night in a quiet environment, talking about their day would really help your child.
We're talking with teacher Rafe Esquith about his book, Lighting Their Fires. Stay tuned for more of our interview after the break.
Children need schools more than they need jails, and that's where for a healthy nation. And we're fired up, ain't gonna take it no more. We're tied up, ain't gonna take it no more. You say cool down, we say step down. You're breaking my mother's heart. Shame, shame. How could we forget that the children come first? We left them alone and they died of thirst.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're speaking right now with Master Teacher Rafe Eswith, who teaches at Hobart Elementary School in Los Angeles. He's just written a book for parents called Lighting Their Fires. Eswith is famous for his theater group of fourth and fifth graders, the Hobart Shakespeareans. Rafe Eswith, you teach your students about ethics and good character through reading great literature like Shakespeare and Mark Twain, even very young children. Talking about very difficult things in Huckleberry Finn.
Sure.
You teach that. It's almost as if you are really unafraid to stretch their minds around these concepts.
You know, there's a reason why people like Mark Twain and Shakespeare have survived hundreds of years. It's because they're really great. And they write about themes that are universally human. I mean, Huck is a kid trying to find honor in a world that is dishonorable. What, you don't think kids today can understand that? Of course they can, if they have us to guide them. I can't tell a 10-year-old child, hey, Huck Finn's a great book, go home and read it. I read the books with them. We read every page together. And no, like Atticus Finch says in To Kill a Mockingbird, do not be afraid to talk about the big issues with children. It doesn't mean we have to give them all the gory details, but when a child asks a question, let's give them a straight answer.
Now, you've had a few disappointments.
Of course.
along the way there, you had kids drop out of your program who you thought were pretty promising on the one hand, but then you've also had unexpected successes, like a kid who was very bright and successful academically, but seemed to be pretty selfish, and then you found out that your lessons can take, that you can't expect your lessons to take right away. It may take
a few
years.
Absolutely true. You know, it's not a Hollywood movie where everything works out at a certain, you know, by act three. Recently, before I talk about those kids, this happened after I wrote the book. I just got a letter from a kid who I hadn't heard from in 22 years. 22 years. And his journey is amazing. The problems he had and the heartbreaks he had. And today, he's a law school graduate. And he's a member of the United States Circuit Court of Appeals. And he traced it back to our classroom. So sometimes the seeds that we plant don't sprout right away. But I think we as parents and teachers have to keep planting them. There's a kid who was incredibly selfish, and despite all my attempts, I never thought I broke through to him. And yet in the 12th grade, he interned in a science lab in another state and was paid money and took a bus over 100 miles to come back to my classroom and give the kids the money. So didn't tell them, by the way, that he gave them the money. He did it quietly. Mm-hmm. So he became a very unselfish kid, and he's doing all kinds of wonderful charity work now. And if you had told me 8 years ago that would have happened, I would have said, not a chance.
Oh, that's cool.
I think the lesson is we just got to keep pitching. We've got to keep trying, even when we have those discouraging moments.
Yeah, and he was giving you money so that you could take the kids to things like baseball
exactly,
games.
Exactly, because it meant something to him when he was a child, even though at the time he didn't understand.
Now, you say he didn't even tell them that he gave them the money.
Nope.
And you say that humility is the most important character trait.
I think it's one of the hardest things to teach because our society doesn't celebrate humility. I mean, we glorify athletes and pop stars who's posing and the look at me, and it's all about me. And athletes who don't even care about their team as long as they get on YouTube. It's very hard sometimes to tell children, you know, there's another way to do things. You know, you can hit a home run without taunting the other team. But it is something that I work real hard on, and in literature, as you pointed out, and on film and in real life, I show them examples of people who are very humble, even though they're amazing at something, and I admire those people, and I want to show the kids that maybe they might want to think about admiring them too.
And why do you say it's the most important character trait?
I don't know if it's the most important. I think it's one of the most appealing. I certainly don't like people who brag and who show off. I don't think any of us do.
Mm-hmm.
And I always admired people who can surprise us by being brilliant at something, and no one knows it. Of course, the classic example from literature that I use with kids all the time is Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird, whose own children don't believe he can do anything until they find out he's the best shot in town. He just doesn't tell them, and what's great is that when they realize that the little girl scout wants to rush off and tell everybody at school, but her older brother, who starts to understand, says, no, Scout, don't tell anybody. You see, Atticus is a gentleman just like me. I think kids, when they start hearing stories like that, they start to realize that there's something wonderful about being great and just keeping it to yourself.
And you don't really think much of the culture of self-esteem. And it's not as if you don't want the kids to esteem themselves.
Sure. I mean, the joke I always tell is that, you know, first of all, the world doesn't care about your self-esteem. They want you to accomplish something first. And I have seen a lot of classrooms where the kids feel great about themselves, but they're not really doing anything. So I think it's better to quietly accomplish all kinds of things. And, you know, you show me a great reader or a great problem solver or a kid who's a great musician, they have plenty of self-esteem. I just think that the people with the best self-esteem don't have to let the whole world know that they're great at something. I think they let their work speak for themselves.
Yeah, and also that intrinsic sense of satisfaction I think you talked about before.
Yeah, there's the beautiful story I tell that comes from Arthur Miller's great play, Death of a Salesman, when Willie Loman's two boys make fun of a neighbor boy who's kind of a nerdy kid when they're children, but that little kid grows up to be an important lawyer, and at the end of the book, he's going to argue a case in front of the Supreme Court, and when his two childhood friends are amazed, and they mention, well, he didn't even say he was doing that. And his father says, well, he didn't say anything because he is doing it. He doesn't have to say anything. And that's, I think, the highest form of self-esteem. It's a quiet confidence instead of a shouting at the world.
Well, Rafe Esquith, your book is Lighting Their Fires. It's a book for parents to teach character and good conduct and passion to their children in the way that you have done so well in your own classroom at Hobart Elementary School in California. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Rafe Esquith of Hobart Elementary School in Los Angeles. You'll find a link to a great video of the Hobart Shakespeareans in the play A Merchant of Venice by going to writersvoice.net. Kim John Payne says kids are being traumatized by what he calls the four pillars of too much. Too much stuff, too much information, too many choices, and lives that are moving too fast. He says every kid has their quirks, but if you add constant and cumulative stress to a child's life, their quirks can become disorders, like ADD or obsessive-compulsive disorder. His book, Simplicity Parenting, shows how parents can bring their kids back to a more balanced way of being that honors their individual personalities. Kim John Payne has been counseling teachers, parents, and children for 24 years about behavior at home and at school. He's the director of the Waldorf Collaborative Counseling Program at Antioch University, New England. When I spoke with him last December, I started out by asking him to tell us more about the four pillars of too much.
The first pillar is that of the environment, you know, like too many toys, too many books, too many clothes, just too much. The second pillar is that of rhythm, of actually strengthening rhythm and predictability in a child's life. And I find that by strengthening rhythm, the children just really thrive on that kind of predictability. So that's got to do with resiliency and having a child be strong and become who they, their full capacity, basically, of who they can be. Then that third pillar that you mentioned is scheduling and being really cautious about overscheduling. And the fourth is filtering adult information. A lot of kids are getting unbelievable amounts of adult information now that we never got, Francesca. Those forces coming into our family from marketing, from media, from ubiquitous stress, from high-stakes testing, from everywhere we look, there's almost like there's an undeclared war on childhood. It's almost like the layers around our family are thinning. So therefore, in writing this book with Lisa Ross, I tried to put together what it is to actually add some protection, some buffering, so that our children can develop resiliency. Now, a lot of when people hear about simplicity parenting, they sort of might think about Little House on the Prairie or something, you know, like going back in time. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm suggesting developing resiliency for our children. And one of the ways to do that is to bring balance into their lives, is to have one third that is busy. You know, stress is not a bad thing. To learn how to cope with that is a skill right there. That's okay for about a third of the time of a child's life. And then another third of the time is got to be what I think of as deep creative play. And then another third has got to do with just downtime, letting them just hang out. And a lot of the problems with letting kids hang out is that parents have bought into this whole kind of parental arms race thing. It's like parenting is a competitive sport, if you know what I mean. And they're good parents, you know, these are well-meaning parents. And when we buy into that, we find it really hard to let our kids just have boredom, have downtime. When my kids come to me and say, "Dad, you know, I'm bored." And I say, "Oh, that's a pity." And then they come back and, "Dad, I'm really bored." And I say, that's a real pity. And within about, you know, 15, 20 minutes, they're doing some of the most creative things that you can imagine. So boredom is the precursor to creativity, and we shouldn't be afraid of it.
Kim John Payne started his career working with children in refugee camps on the border between Thailand and Cambodia.
When I was in the Thai-Cambodian refugee camps, I saw a bunch of fairly stressed kids. And it was very understandable, of course, of why they would be stressed. But after I was finished there and I came back and I worked in the West, and I had a regular family counseling practice again, there were just a procession of kids coming into my clinic who were just regular rascals, you know, different socioeconomic sort of groups and different ethnic backgrounds. And I was seeing the same symptoms. I was seeing nervous kids. I was seeing hypervigilant kids. I was seeing kids who were trying to over-control their environment. And that's a big one. I was seeing kids that mistrusted anything new. And that's a big problem with learning. And I thought, my goodness, there I was in Asia seeing a bunch of what you could call kids who were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And here is a bunch of kids in the West who are presenting in exactly the same way.
Well, tell us more about what those symptoms were, because that was a very striking finding.
One of the ones that caused a lot of trouble was the over-controlling behavior. Because when you're feeling your life is going too fast, too quick, and you then try and control everything around you, your parents, your siblings, your teachers, the playground, and that can lead to all kinds of really quite difficult behavior. And the other one, as I mentioned, was anything new. And that's almost the antithesis to learning. So these kids were in fight or flight, but they were also in freeze or flock. They were getting together in small groups, gangs, picking on other kids. It led to a lot of social problems. But it also other kids who were a little more introverted were freezing, were blocking anything new, were not reaching out to make friends and so on. And so I was seeing a very identifiable stress reaction. Only the thing about this was that these kids hadn't been through war. And so this was the puzzle. I'm thinking, well, you know, what's happening here? Why is this?
And it actually took you some time to take what you were seeing and figure out what it was. What did you come up with?
Well, you know, I looked at these kids' biographies and thought, you know what? They don't have any huge amounts of stress, but what they do have is cumulative stress. The small stressors. The problem with these stressors is that they are so ubiquitous now that as a society, we've come to think of them as normal. Too much, too fast, too quick, too soon, too stressed, too sexy, too early. And what's happening is we're raising a whole generation of essentially neurologically damaged kids.
Neurologically damaged?
Yeah, part of their brain that is developing and controlling and in charge of a lot of their behavior is not the frontal lobes, not the neocortex or the prefrontal cortex, which is all our finer empathies and new learning and being interested in the world and reaching out.
And also being able to anticipate and organize and control impulses.
Control impulses is the big one. Delay, gratification, control impulses. Exactly. And have a sense of timing. Those centers are being inhibited by the tremendous activity around the amygdala, which is our ancient brain, which is our sort of reptilian brain, it's sometimes referred to, which is that fight or flight response. So having noticed that these kids were suffering from what I came to think of as cumulative stress reaction. The difficulty was it was normal. And so I thought, okay, now what about if we just take the stress away? Now, these parents were coming to me as a therapist because I was often the therapist of last resort, so I could suggest slightly strange things. It's a great position to be in. And I suggested, what about we start backing off some of the overscheduling or some of the media. Or what about we simplify their bedrooms and with toys? What about we, whatever it was, really, there was no formula, just whatever was causing them stress. And I'd ask them, what is causing your child the most stress? And out of that would then come a plan that we develop, often with the most doable things first, the ones that were simplest and easily done and you'd feel successful in doing. And then we would start to work on the bigger ones.
You start with toys. So that could be a pretty radioactive issue, couldn't it?
Yeah, I've got to be careful here that I'm not known as the Grinch with an Australian accent, you know. One of the things that is a really good place to start is to think about the amount of clutter. When we think about the whole too much, the whole concept of too much, we can start really practical. I mean, it's just a footstep into some of the more, I think, potentially more important issues. But the average child has over 150 toys. You know, they have hundreds of books, hundreds of items, garments, clothing, and it's just too much.
And what is, I mean, aside from the fact that it might be hard to get through to your bed if you're a kid, what is the problem with too much stuff?
Well, let's take the example of books and maybe toys as well. What I've discovered was this. When the parents would start taking away the books, you know, basically just leaving out two or three books, and getting over this whole thing of books as being a sign of sort of higher academic cognitive development. The more books we can have out on a shelf, the better we are.
And you don't mean throwing the books out?
I mean throwing some or passing some on that are inappropriate. But no, I mean putting them away and having a library. And what we found is that the children, if basically, to sum it up, if you want your child to have a lifelong learn of reading, give them fewer books for about 3 or 4 weeks, maybe even 4 or 5 weeks, and let them go deeply into it. I love books, and for that reason, we need to give our children fewer, and the same is with toys. One of the things we discovered is that in really taking half the toys away and then half again, and then half again, and leaving a child with a small amount of toys. Some toys are very, very special, and you'd never take those away. But a lot of them are just plain annoying. You know, they're developmentally inappropriate. They're annoying. It's always the expensive ones that break first, but they cost so much money, you tend to hang on to them. And so by getting rid of those, the child's play becomes more settled. It becomes more creative. And the kind of toys that I found most parents were keen to get rid of, and I've got a bias in this, but I just watched the ones they wanted to get rid of. And then I watched the ones they wanted to keep. And the ones they wanted to keep almost always were the simpler toys. They were the toys that weren't finished. They were the toys that the child's imagination could do something with.
Give us some examples.
Well, some of these toys are just the simplest things. I mean, they're even just construction things. They're blocks. They are large pieces of material that the children can just turn into 100 different things: a house, a beautiful princess's dress, or the things that can have multiple uses. And that's one of the ways to judge, I think, of whether a toy is going to stimulate a child's creativity is whether it can have many, many different uses, or whether it's a finished product and can only really be played with in one way.
Mm. You also say that a lot of these kids really don't miss the toys.
No, not at all. You expect the children to somehow feel a little, bereft of all these toys. Actually, they start in all these years of doing this with countless numbers of families. We've just seen over and over again the children relish this. They relish the space to play, and they get right into that kind of deep creative play. Now, the same is true with clothes, the same is true with much of the clutter that surrounds our homes.
We're talking with Kim John Payne. His book is Simplicity Parenting, Using the Extraordinary Power of Less to Raise Calmer, Happier, and More Secure Kids. You've been in positions where you've given diagnoses to children, and I get the sense it's not something you really like to do. We know that a lot of children are being diagnosed, more and more kids are being diagnosed with ADHD, with obsessive compulsive disorder, even with bipolar disorder, which was unheard of, you know, a few decades ago. You actually say that simplifying children's lives can be an alternative to medication in helping children who have these diagnoses come closer to a baseline of normal.
One of the things that we noticed over the years of doing this is that all kids are quirky. They all have their own individual quirks that makes them who they are. And if you have two or three children in a family, they've all got different ones. But what we found is that if you add cumulative stress to a child's life, then those quirks become their disorder. What I mean by that is the very busy child, for example, when you add cumulative stress to his or her life, that child can easily and quickly slide along a spectrum into hyperactivity and questions around medication and names that you've never heard before start coming up. And no parent wants to hear that. That is really scary stuff. And what we found is that as we backed the kids off, when we introduced cumulative simplicity as an alternative to cumulative stress, the kids became quirky again. They started moving backwards from the so-called disorder into just being quirky. But look, a really unexpected thing happened is that they didn't stop at just being quirky. As the parents kind of bought into this whole idea of just giving their kids downtime, not speaking so much in front of them, backing off screens, just allowing them a childhood, the quirk became a gift. And we didn't expect this. Let's take ADHD as an example. We could take ODD, OCD. It's like macabre waltz of the D's, isn't it? But what we found was that kids who were so-called ADD or ADHD, hyperactive or inattentive type, when their parents backed them off that and gave them simplicity in scheduling, simplicity in their bedrooms, in their playrooms, simplicity with what they see with their eyes, what they touch with their hands, just backed it off. Those kids, yeah, they came back to being busy, but then their gift was this amazing sense of being movers and shakers, of being able to change something. And one of the things that I noticed, and with the team that I had working with me, was that it was a question over and over again was timing. Before, what they were doing when they were being sort of pressure being put on for Ritalin or Adderall or whatever it was, they were doing pretty good things, but they were doing them at the wrong time, in the wrong place. There was almost a freneticness to what they were doing.
Even if they were on medication?
If they were on medication, to some extent it was masked, but the wheels are turning inwardly. And they're burning that rubber. You got one foot on the brake and one foot on the gas. Mm-hmm. Now, I think of medication as scaffolding. The point of it is to take it away, is to move to a place that needs strengthening and then to take the scaffolding away. There are over 9 million kids on Ritalin in this country. In the United States, we consume 92% of all Ritalin that's consumed in the world, all these the various Ritalin and the likes.
Yeah, and one surprising thing, I know with Ritalin, they have found in studies that children may calm down and become more tractable in the classroom, but it really doesn't impact their grades. In other words, their grades don't improve. And I'm sure that there are parents out there who will say, well, you know, my kids' grades improve. But overall, the scientific studies haven't shown much improvement. You found with making simplicity the medication that they did.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is that together with a dear friend and colleague from right here in Amherst, actually, Arthur Zients from Amherst College, we launched a study into this. And it was a pilot study, 55 children in 32 schools, all diagnosed with both hyperactivity and inattentiveness. These were, you know, children who were really, really struggling. And what we found with a simplicity regime is that 68% of them went from clinically ADHD to typical, below the 71st percentile, so that was you deal with all this data when you're doing this sort of stuff, within 4 months. Within 4 months, they'd gone from one to being, they're still kind of rascals, but teachable, reachable. Mm-hmm. But what I've found, though, is that...
Not rascals, spirited.
Depends which side of the pond you're on, I think. Yes, but the... what would start to happen is that the reason these kids would do so well is that now, with a simplicity regime, what they would do is that they would still have this amazing energy and verve, but now they knew when. It was a question of timing. They had had enough calmness in their life to when they then wanted to sense the moment. And that's a skill that is one of the most important skills in terms of what we can do to be successful in life. And this is the interesting thing with a simplicity regime, is that we want our kids to have timing. We want our kids to have empathy. But we want our kids to notice the moment, and when that moment is right, to go for it. And the reason that I'm so pleased with watching these children grow up is that I'm watching them grow up now into being really good mummies and daddies, of course. But in this changing economy and in this changing world, more than ever, we need kids who can be out there and not have to rely on the jobs for life anymore. They need to be a little entrepreneurial. They need to look about them. They need to be able to shift gears. They need to know, to have a sense of when is the right time.
And yes, of course, kids who have ADHD are often very entrepreneurial, turn into very entrepreneurial adults. They are interested in many different things and are highly creative. And the timing is, as you say, often the thing that sabotages them.
Well, you know, likewise, with kids who are diagnosed with obsessive compulsive issues, that's the developmental shadow. Absolutely, it is. That's if you add a complexity to their lives, that pushes them along that spectrum. Their quirk is that they're just little organizers, but their gift is they can see patterns. They can see patterns within complexity. And with seeing those kinds of patterns, they can order things in such a way that is incredibly useful to any organization, a home, but particularly in the workplace. So I'm also concerned with the amount of kids who are being diagnosed now with Asperger's and nonverbal learning disorder. And I know there are kids genuinely that have this, you know, and really struggle with this. But one of the other things that I've noticed is that as you simplify these children's lives, they start to be able to pick up social cues. Because one of the great things is a lot of the kids diagnosed in this way can't pick up social cues, don't have it. We're back to timing again. Don't have a sense of being able to reach out into the world and see what is appropriate and inappropriate. Sometimes that's a bit off. That's not quite right with the children who are struggling with these issues. Just dozens and dozens and dozens of parents who have been trying this medication or that doctor or this way, when they introduce a simplicity regime, they find, because their children are calmer, that they have a much higher rate of actually calibrating their reactions and their actions, both, in a way that is no longer troubling to other kids. They don't think they're weird anymore. That's one of the things that we see across the board with most of these so-called diagnoses, is that the kids become quirky and then they actually uncover their gifts. It's a wonderful thing.
Kim John Payne. His book is Simplicity Parenting. You can hear our extended interview with him at writersvoice.net, read an excerpt from his book, and find links to his website with a lot more information about his work. Just go to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. You can listen to all our shows, plus find out much more about our guests and their books at writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.